Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 15th of June, these are our main stories. Evidence of acute food shortages and starvation in North Korea, with some people dying in the streets. Greece declares 3 days of national mourning after at least 79 migrants died in a shipwreck off its southern coast. And scientists have engineered polio vaccines to prevent them mutating into a dangerous form that can cause outbreaks of the disease. Also in this podcast, in Milan, Italy says farewell to the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi with a state funeral. North Korea is in a period of unprecedented isolation. It's been more than 3 years since it sealed its borders in response to the COVID pandemic, and it hasn't reopened them. This has likely created some of the harshest conditions North Koreans have ever had to live through. Three people living in North Korea have risked their lives to tell the BBC what is happening. We've been secretly communicating with them for months with the help of an organisation in South Korea called Daily NK. Our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie, says food is so scarce, their neighbours are starving to death.
Where can you see people, sir?
On the main road, there's three people.
Walking?
Yeah, on the rice paddies.
Yeah.
These days, the only way to catch a glimpse of life in North Korea is to come up to the border in South Korea and peer across the river using binoculars, which is what I'm doing now.
One of them's bending down and picking things up to put into a basket. There's a row of houses just behind them in the distance.
Kim Jong-un, terrified that COVID would wipe out his malnourished population, sealed the border. No one has been allowed into the country for years. And for a long time, the government even stopped food and medicine crossing the border. Many are worried the country could be on the brink of a famine.
Food supplies are so low. People have started dying.
This is a man we're calling Chan Ho. He lives on the other side of the border. And he's one of three North Koreans we've been secretly communicating with for months. All of our interviewees' words have been voiced by actors.
I work on construction projects. Often we have to work late into the night and I sleep at the site. In our village, five people are starved to death. In one family, their wife was too ill to work, so her two children were surviving by begging. In the end, all three of them died. At first, I was afraid of dying from COVID, but then I began to worry about starving to death.
Talking directly to people in North Korea is impossible. And so we've worked with an organisation that has a network of sources in the country called Daily NK.
Hello, 안녕하세요. Nice to see you again.
그분들이 이렇게 협력하고 있는 얘기는...
The editor, Lee Sang-yong, tells me his sources have found people they trust who want to talk to us.
전화할 수 있다라고 하는 것들도...
And so for months, these sources help deliver our questions and relay the answers. At a market near the border works a woman we're calling Myung-suk. Like many North Koreans, she makes her living by selling items smuggled into the country.
Most of the products in the market came from China, but it's empty now. You could always find grain, but not these days. It's become much harder to smuggle things over the border. I tried to smuggle, but I got caught. I had to bribe an official with money I didn't have and barely got away with it.
With barely anything to sell, Myung-suk's earnings have halved.
Our food situation has never been this bad. Recently, people have been knocking on the door asking for food because they're so hungry.
Hundreds of miles away, in the relative luxury of the capital, Pyongyang, supplies are also running out, says this woman we're calling Ji-yun.
Once, I didn't eat for 2 days. I thought I was going to die in my sleep at night. My husband and I survived by thinking 10 more days, and then another 10 days. We might starve, but at least we'll feed our kids. There are lots of beggars now. If they're lying down, we check them and usually find they're dead. There are others who kill themselves at home or disappear into the mountains.
These are the cries of an emaciated, unblinking child living through the North Korean famine of the late 1990s, where as many as 3 million people died. What these people are sharing now evokes memories of this awful time. To help make sense of our findings, I brought them to Peter Ward, an economist who studies North Korea.
It's all well and good to say you've heard about people starving to death, but if you know people in your immediate vicinity who are, that implies that the food situation is very serious. We're not talking about full-scale social collapse and widespread starvation yet, but it does not look good.
But the spectre of history has not stopped Kim Jong-un from funneling his limited finances into building nuclear weapons and parading them through the streets of Pyongyang. Last year, he tested a record number of missiles, the cost of which, according to some estimates, could have fed his entire country for the year. This sticks in Ji-yun's throat.
The people never wanted this endless weapons development that brings hardship to generation after generation. We feel hugely betrayed. I want to live in a society where we don't starve, where my neighbors are alive.
That report by Jean McKenzie. And we put our findings to the North Korean DPRK government. A representative from its embassy in London said, "The information you have collected is not entirely factual, as it's derived from fabricated testimonies from anti-DPRK forces. The DPRK has always prioritised the interests of the people, even at difficult times, and has an unwavering commitment to the well-being of the people." The Greek government has declared 3 days of mourning to mark the deaths of at least 79 migrants who drowned when their boat capsized off the southern coast. About 100 people have been rescued. Many more are missing. A migration charity, Alarm Phone, believes that as many as 750 people were on board the ship. The UN Secretary General said he was horrified at the loss of so many lives. His spokesman is Stéphane Dujarric.
He stressed, as he said before, that every person searching for a better life needs dignity and safety. This is yet another example of the need of member states to come together and create orderly, safe pathways for people forced to flee and for comprehensive action to save lives at sea and reduce perilous journeys.
Rebecca Kesby spoke to the Athens-based journalist Daphne Tollis and asked her how many people she thought were on board the boat before it capsized.
The reports that are coming from the witnesses, from the people that were witnessing the actual shipwreck that survived, they are speaking of numbers that could be more than 600 people. Many people were sitting on the deck, it seems, apparently, and some of the people said that there were many more below the deck, seated hidden underneath. So if this is confirmed, we are probably seeing more than, I don't know, a few hundreds of people that will be missing, if not found.
And we know it launched from Libya, but I suppose the nationalities of people on board could range from all over the place.
Exactly. So far, we know that there are people from Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, according to the survivors again. And it seems that they all knew when they all were heading to Italy, not to Greece.
Daphne, we hear that the Greek Coast Guard actually says that the boat had been spotted by their surveillance plane on Tuesday afternoon, but that the passengers had refused any help. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, apparently, yes, they had spotted a boat overcrowded with people. And then there was a Frontex reconnaissance drone flying as well. Somehow they said they contacted and they were located, and they asked them if they needed any assistance. They said, no, we're just fine. We're just heading to Italy. This was a press release released by the Hellenic Coast Guard today.
Yes. And is there any understanding as to why there could be reluctance to get involved with the Greek Coast Guard at that point? We have just heard from a volunteer who works with Alarm Phone, and he described some of these tactics of pushback that have been used in the waters around Greece before.
So the statement by the Greek Coast Guard reads that there was one or two cargo ships that approached the vessel to provide some supplies and assistance, but then they refused both supplies and assistance. And they said that we do not need any help, stating their desire to continue their trip to Italy. These are recorded calls, apparently. But as my understanding is, because of these so-called or these reported pushbacks, people are maybe trying to avoid crossing to Greece. So launching from Libya, I wouldn't imagine that they were coming to Greece, but going to Italy, and somehow in on the way, because of some problem with the engine, there weren't any high winds last night. And some people I'm in contact with, that they're saying they have some family members on board and they were all heading to Italy.
Daphne Tollis. To Ukraine now, where intense fighting is being reported across various fronts. The Ukrainian authorities say its counteroffensive has liberated a number of settlements in the Donetsk region in the east. This Ukrainian soldier spoke to a Reuters journalist in the area.
3 days ago, we liberated the village of Storoshevo. You can see for yourselves how it was achieved. You can see the destroyed hardware. Glory to Ukraine.
Our correspondent, Myeni Jones, is in Kiev.
Rafael Grossi, the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, was due to visit the Zaporizhia nuclear plant this week, but he's had to postpone his trip indefinitely for safety reasons. And that's because the region of Zaporizhia is one of the front lines of Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russian forces. The fact that Mr. Grossi is unable to visit the nuclear plant at a time when he says he needs to check whether the water levels of the cooling pools around the nuclear plant that were affected by the damage to the Kakhovka Dam last week. He's concerned that water levels, there's a discrepancy in the water levels that have been reported versus what's been measured. The fact that he's unable to visit that site, I think, indicates just how fraught the security situation is across Ukraine at the moment. Earlier this morning, we saw strikes on the port city of Odessa launched from a Russian ship in the Black Sea. That damaged a restaurant and a warehouse. 3 people were killed and about 13 were injured. Further east in the Donetsk region, there were also strikes on a couple of cities, on residential properties there. 3 people were killed and 3 were injured. And all of this emphasizes what President Zelensky has been saying, that with an increase, with this uptick in missile strikes from the Russians, they need more firepower. They need to be able to fight back, both by having solid air defense systems, but also by having fighter jets.
Myeni Jones. Italy has marked the death of its former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi with a state funeral held in Milan's vast Gothic cathedral. The one-time cruise singer, who rose to power with no prior political experience, died on Monday, aged 86. While opposition politicians accused him of cronyism and corruption, hundreds of supporters gathered around large screens to watch the state funeral, the kind of tribute usually reserved for popes, war heroes and serving ministers. Our correspondent Sofia Bettiza was outside the cathedral.
Much like his life, Silvio Berlusconi's funeral was a spectacle, attended by political leaders, his family, as well as a string of ex-girlfriends. The atmosphere in Milan's main square was very emotional, as thousands gathered to say a final farewell to Il Cavaliere, the Knight, as he was nicknamed. They were waving flags, clapping, and some were crying. As Berlusconi's coffin was taken inside the cathedral, they chanted, "Silvio will always be our president." The grand televised event was attended by nearly 2,000 people, many Italian political figures, but very few world leaders, an indication that Berlusconi was a divisive figure, famous abroad for his crude jokes and his bunga bunga sex parties. Inside the cathedral, in the first row, were his 5 children. Behind the scenes, a true succession story is playing out. Berlusconi was one of Italy's richest men, but he never publicly indicated who should lead his business empire after his death. So will he distribute his fortune equally among his five children, or will his two eldest, who are more business savvy, get more? Berlusconi was said to be the glue that held his family together, but that unity might not survive now that he's gone. So what is his legacy going to be? James Imam is a journalist based in Milan.
He'll be remembered, of course, for being Mr. Italy and for being somebody that perhaps didn't do wonders for the reputation of Italy, its position in the world stage, and perhaps even its economic stability after the 2011 financial crash. I suppose he'll also be remembered as the first great populist, the person that preceded Trump, Boris Johnson, Bolsonaro.
During his sermon, the Archbishop of Milan said, "To be happy means to love parties, to enjoy life to the fullest, and to have a sense of humour." A sentence that perfectly encapsulates Silvio Berlusconi's flamboyant life.
Sofia Bertizza in Milan. Still to come.
Do you mean you're Mary Jane Watson?
Face it, Tiger. You just hit the jackpot.
We remember the work of John Romita Sr., the man who introduced superhero Spider-Man to Mary Jane.
The Explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And welcome back. A Chinese-Australian artist known for his work criticising the government of President Xi Jinping says Chinese diplomats tried to shut down his latest exhibition, which is due to open on Friday in the Polish capital, Warsaw. The artist, who's known as Badiou Cao, said embassy officials pressured both the gallery and the government to stop the exhibition from going ahead, calling it an attack on China and Chinese leaders. James Menendez spoke to Badiou Cao to find out more.
As a Chinese dissident artist, this kind of harassment is no stranger to me. But this time, it is actually the first time the Chinese embassy sending diplomats in person to the museum, which is hosting my show. So what happened is last Tuesday, I believe the second in command, Mr. Yao from the Chinese embassy in Poland, came to Ujazdowski Contemporary Art Center in person and demanded meeting the director of the museum to express his protest against my coming exhibition and saying, "The image on the poster is a very bad effort to kind of attack China's leader, and it's hurting the Chinese feelings." And because of that, he demanded the show to be cancelled. Lately, the Culture Ministry of Poland also received a letter from the Chinese embassy, basically citing the same thing, that they do not want the museum have this exhibition being opened.
You mentioned the poster, the promotional poster for the exhibition. Just tell us what that depicts.
It's showing basically Xi Jinping is divining a torso of a child. It is a direct referencing of the masterpiece from Francis Goethe's Satan Divine His Children. Well, to me, I think it's a perfect metaphor just showing how this dictator is, you know, oppress its own people and also expanding its aggression all over the world.
You can understand why the Chinese authorities are upset by that image, can't you?
Well, yes, I think criticism against politicians or government is widely acceptable and is being seen as a just normal right for freedom of expression in the Western society or in democracy. But for an authoritarian government like China, certainly they feel a hard time to seeing any form of criticism.
But the point is that they're trying to exert that desire to censor your work, not in China, but in Poland in this case.
Exactly. That's why we see China now is just not a authoritarian government, but it's also totalitarian, which means it has been much more aggressive compared with before. And as a China-born Australian artist, my art has been censored all over the world. That almost every time I do any exhibition, particularly in Europe, the Chinese embassy or consulate will send in threatening letter or calling private number of the museum staff or curators demanding the show to be cancelled. And most of the time, they get their way.
You say they get their way. What, have they managed to shut down exhibitions in other countries then?
Well, in 2018, they actually managed to shut in my exhibition in Hong Kong by threatening my family member back in China and saying they are going to send in the mainland police to the Hong Kong venue if we choose to proceed with the show. I have to highlight this. This is in 2018, way before the whole national security law being enforced in Hong Kong.
Yes, but of course Hong Kong is part of China, and it's a slightly different situation to a country like Poland. What's been the response from the Polish government and indeed the gallery that's hosting your exhibition? Are they going to back down in any way?
I'm very grateful and happy that now the museum has made a very strong statement in solidarity with my rights of expression, as well as in a form to protect their own rights to express through the art.
The Chinese-Australian artist Ba Diu Cao. We did contact the Chinese embassy in Poland for their response. As yet, there has been no reply. Scientists from the UK have helped to create a super-engineered polio vaccine that they hope will help to finally wipe out the disease, which can cause paralysis. The World Health Organization has welcomed the breakthrough, as our health and science correspondent James Gallagher explained.
The oral polio vaccine, which used to be given on a sugar cube, has transformed the world. Cases of polio have fallen by 99% since the 1980s, and millions have been spared paralysis. However, it has one flaw. The vaccine is made from weakened live polio viruses. It takes only one mutation for these viruses to regain the ability to infect the nervous system and cause paralysis. There are now more cases of vaccine-derived polio than the original or wild form of the disease. The polio detected in London sewers last year came from the oral vaccine. So the team of researchers at the UK's National Institute for Biological Standards and Control and the University of California, San Francisco, re-engineered the vaccine. Dr. Andrew McAdam said they were keeping the virus locked in its weakened state.
By genetically modifying part of the virus, we could modify that region so that it couldn't revert. And this, I think, has been remarkably successful.
The first such vaccines they developed have been used more than 600 million times. Now they've produced upgraded vaccines against all three types of polio. The World Health Organization said such vaccines would play a significant role in ridding the world of polio. However, it warned one of the biggest challenges is actually getting vaccines to every child in the world.
That was James Gallagher. A new global study suggests that the number of people taking a strong interest in the news has dropped by around a quarter in the past 6 years. A report by Oxford University's Reuters Institute says 48% of people around the world are very or extremely interested in the news, down from 63% in 2017. More than a third of people worldwide say they sometimes or often actively avoid the news. My colleague James Reynolds brought together an editor, a producer, and a radio presenter to discuss how they are trying to incorporate more positive news into their programmes. Karen Martin, as you know, is editor of this podcast and also of the new weekly Happy Pod. Jeff Jones is a senior producer at Minnesota Public Radio, and Brown Berry is a radio presenter on YFM, a BBC partner in Accra in Ghana. James first asked Brown Berry how he balances what he gives to his listeners.
We want to make people very happy. We want to make sure the youth are excited, they are happy, they're able to look forward to an inspiring future, right? So we make sure the music is very exciting. We make sure the music is very exciting, first of all. We make sure we focus on extremely great news every single time. This is something that we're very particular about as a station. So yeah, for us, half the work is already done because, yes, the station is laid back. We're not giving you bad news. We're not giving you sad news. We're focusing on the more exciting part of life.
Let's
let's bring in Karen Martin. And Karen, to explain to our audience, we have these running orders in our BBC system, and I go into these running orders to get this programme up. And the other day, I saw something called the Happy Podcast or Happy News. And I thought, what is that? That's you. Talk us through it.
That is me. Happy afternoon, James. Thanks for having us. I'm also the editor of the Global News Podcast, which is the BBC's most popular podcast. And that's a twice-a-day news podcast. And like you were saying at the top of this item, you know, we do try and look for light and shade. But sort of by definition, let's be frank, it's been, world events have been pretty brutal over the past few years. So we've had a pandemic and the invasion of Ukraine and climate change, natural disasters, political turmoil, you know, and our job is to cover those. But listeners started to say, wow, it's just like too bleak sometimes, you know, and listening to the news feels like work. And, you know, when you're not feeling that great yourself, are you really ready for it kind of thing? Once a year, we do something called the Happy Pod at Christmas. And this year, for some reason, it probably chimes with this report. People wrote in January and said, but why is it once a year? We need more of that stuff, you know. Need more of the happy stuff. And I think we've got some clips of listeners explaining what they wanted.
Hi there, I'm Shane Godden from Toronto, Canada. I do feel that it's important to continue to provide, you know, the sometimes grim stories that you currently are. Please do both. We would love happy news.
Hi, I'm Chelsea Kenya from London, and I'm a daily listener, and I love the idea of a weekly happy news episode.
I've always felt that the news is too slanted towards disasters and unfortunate events. Doesn't give a realistic, balanced view of how the world is. I can understand that bad news is more immediate and attention-grabbing.
I'm Lily Jenkins. You know, I guess we want you guys sharing news from around the world on what is happening. And if a lot of it tends to be sad and depressing, then that is just the state of times that we live in.
So there you have it, you know, straight from the listeners' mouths, as it were, about what it is they're looking for. I think, you know, where's the hope and where's the joy is a reasonable question to ask. I think, I mean, you and I have both worked in news for a long time, and I think perhaps we need to consider what the definition of news is. And are we sort of still, you know, is it quite a macho kind of concept that it's about war and death and destruction? Or is it, in fact, just new information that people don't know about that they'd be interested in? That can be, it could be inspiring and uplifting. It can be something that makes you feel good. And that doesn't have to mean light and fluffy. I think when I was talking about this idea to the BBC bosses, you know, I'll be honest, there are a few raised eyebrows, a little bit of a shaking of the head. It's kind of, if we do this, what are we saying about the rest of the news? Are we saying that the rest of it is bleak? And I mean, you'll know that there's only so much room in, like you say, a running order. So what we decided was for one half an hour every week on a Saturday, when people are perhaps chilling out a bit more, that we would just be unashamedly looking for good news.
Let's bring in Jeff Jones, senior producer at Minnesota Public Radio, picking up on something that Karen said there, the definition of news. What is that definition for you? And what do you do on a day when that news happens to be really tough and, what we would just say in ordinary words, gloomy?
We have to cover it. People rely on us. You know, they will come to us when the news is huge. I'm here in Minnesota when the death and murder of George Floyd was dominating the headlines around the world. We had to cover it. We couldn't go and cover happy news that day. But then the big question is, well, what do we do in the weeks and months after that, you know, to make sure that we cover the aftermath of that story and also uplift people, talk about the news that's happier, news that's more useful as well. But when Russia invades Ukraine, we're going to turn to our colleagues at the BBC so that we can cover that for our audience. But there's 24 hours in a day and we can give them a mix of lots of things.
Jeff Jones from Minnesota Public Radio. And before him, Karen Martin, our own Karen Martin, and Brown Berry from YFM Radio in Ghana. And if you want to tell us what you think about the importance and balance of the news, you know our email address by now. It is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Oh, and don't forget to subscribe to the Happy Podcast, which is out on Saturdays. Now to a fascinating story, which was something of a surprise, the emotional life of fruit flies. New research suggests that the sight of their dead fellows is enough to drive fruit flies to an early grave themselves. Seeing the corpses of other fruit flies sends them into a kind of depression. Rebecca Kesby heard more from Christy Gendron, the Assistant Professor of Biology at the University of Michigan in the US.
Our lab is interested in how sensory events impact our physiology. And we use Drosophila or the fruit fly to do this. And we were initially looking at how flies would respond to sick flies. And we didn't see anything happen until the flies died. Then the live flies showed shortened longevity as well as decreased fat.
Does this mean then that fruit flies have emotions, or is there something else going on here?
Yes. So we think what happens, I mean, it's a hypothesis, of course, I don't mean to anthropomorphize, but yes, we think that the neural state that arises from what we sense in the world is how we interpret our world, and we label that as emotions. So in this case, it would be more like a depressed-like state, yes.
So what does that tell us then in terms of other animals and potentially even ourselves?
Yes, we think that this is conserved. Across biology, we know that many animals, you know, from insects, elephants, and apes respond to their dead. We think that the neuronal underpinnings or the neurons and the molecules that they use are conserved across biology. For instance, I found that serotonin is in particularly involved, and that is conserved. And the implications of this is we think this is really important for people who are exposed to stressful situations surrounding death, such as soldiers or first responders who suffer from debilitating disorders such as PTSD or cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, I mean, all of that makes sense, doesn't it? But we always like to think humans, well, historically, we like to think that we're a bit special. And one of the things that makes us special is that we know we're going to die, and we assume animals maybe don't. But does this turn that on its head as well?
Of course. I think there's so much to be discovered about what exactly an animal perceives and how it impacts in its thought processes. Of course, we cannot anthropomorphize, but we can use this as a system by which to understand our own underlying biology.
That was Christy Gendron. Now, listen to this.
Do you mean you're Mary Jane Watson?
Face it, Tiger. You just hit the jackpot.
The moment, perhaps, that Peter Parker, a.k.a. the comic book superhero Spider-Man's life changed forever when his girlfriend Mary Jane Watson turned up. The man who oversaw her introduction was John Romita Sr., who has just died, aged 93. He was art director for the Marvel comic book for two decades from the early 1970s and was behind several of its most popular characters. Terry Egan has this report.
The Vulture, the Hobgoblin, the Kingpin. Just a few of the many personalities John Romita nurtured into comic existence. They're all, of course, having an afterlife in the big-budget world of films. But for him, it all started with DC and Marvel.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web.
Born in Brooklyn, New York, Romita Sr. graduated from Manhattan's School of Industrial Art in 1947 and served in the Army before starting work in comics. He gained a reputation beavering away on titles for National Comics and Timely Comics, the companies that would later become Marvel and DC. From 1966, he worked with editor-in-chief Stan Lee on The Amazing Spider-Man, helping it to become the company's top seller. That's when those characters first appeared, to stun their readers the way Mary Jane Watson turned up to stun Spidey. But he went on to contribute to the design of Luke Cage, played in the films by Mike Coulter, and Wolverine, played by Hugh Jackman.
Oh, Jean, I'm so sorry. I'll never hurt you or anyone ever again.
It's too late.
Romita semi-retired in 1996, but his death comes the week after the latest installment in the Spider-Man film franchise Across the Spider-Verse proved to be a box office hit. No matter what success I've had, he said in 2002, I've always considered myself a guy who can improve on somebody else's concepts. I can make it better. Without John Romita Sr., Spider-Man just wouldn't be half so amazing.
That report by Terry Egan. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I might have mentioned that already. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.